Welcome to Out of Bounds. I'm Tish Perlman. My guest is Dr. Ron Lifer. Lifer is a psychiatrist who received his training at Syracuse University and has more than 45 years' experience in the practice of psychotherapy. In 1980, he became a student and practitioner of Buddhism. He is the founder of the Ithaca Dharma Society and author of several books that fuse his Western and Buddhist insights, including The Happiness Project and his most recent, Vinegar into Honey, Seven Steps to Understanding and Transforming Anger, Aggression, and Violence, published by Snow Lion Publications. Welcome to the show, Ron.
Thank you very much.
Now, before we begin to talk about Vinegar into Honey, I want to talk to you about your philosophy as a psychiatrist. You have essentially rejected the medical model as the dominant paradigm of psychiatry. Talk to us about this.
Well, the medical model has a social and political function because it's a model. It's not a fact and it's not a theory. And the function of it has two functions. The primary function is to give a justification or rationalization for a covert form of social control. Because one of the problems that a free society has is that it's limited by rule of law. We don't often talk about the limitations of rule of law, but the limitation on rule of law is you can't control people without indicting them and trying them legally. But there are many more social disruptions and threatening people than the law permits to prosecute for the sake of social control. So we need a covert form of social control, and the medical model serves that covert form because it says the person is not being addressed because he or she is disruptive or threatening or bizarre. They're being addressed because they're mentally ill. So the whole thing is moved out of the moral and political sphere into a sphere in which it's ostensibly medical. That serves a function of social control.
Mm-hmm. And you're talking about drugs as well, right?
No, I'm talking about involuntary coercive psychiatry.
I see.
And drugs. Mm-hmm. But the involuntary coercive psychiatry serves a political function. I mean, what else does involuntary incarceration serve? That social control.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
The second function it serves is that it defines psychiatrists as doctors. Now, this has a lot of ramifications because when I was being trained in psychoanalysis, psychiatry was a wide-ranging intellectual enterprise. But psychiatrists were gradually being excluded from medicine as real doctors. So they had to reestablish themselves as real doctors for the sake of their professional identity.
Hmm.
So the medical model serves to identify psychiatrists as doctors, but then in turn, psychiatrists have to act like doctors. So they've reduced themselves to simply prescribing drugs.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And you're opposed to prescribing drugs in any form?
No.
Well, what of the people who really are?
I'm not opposed to prescribing drugs.
Because I do know people have been helped.
Well, I prescribe drugs. I don't prescribe antipsychotics. I think they're too dangerous. But I don't see the kind of people that psychiatrists do prescribe them for.
Mm-hmm.
But look, if you've got anxiety that's out of control and you can't function and you're uncomfortable, a little bit of an anti-anxiety agent like Valium or Xanax can really be helpful, provided that you're also addressing the issues underlying the anxiety.
Mm-hmm.
Now, antidepressants are more ambiguous because there is no accurate assessment of how they work or why they work. I've seen people for whom they work, and I do prescribe them occasionally, especially people who come into me already prescribed and it seems to be working for them. I won't deprive them of it.
Mm-hmm.
No, I'm not against responsible people using drugs.
Mm-hmm. But did you believe that psychotherapy can have some of the same results and the over-prescribing of drugs is an excuse for not taking time to use psychotherapy?
Yeah, mm-hmm. People come in misidentifying their problem and actually inaccessible to psychotherapy because they insist they have a biochemical disorder. So I asked them, well, you had a test to show that you have a biochemical imbalance or your doctor did some kind of a test? They say no because there is no test. So I asked them, well, how do you know you have a biochemical disorder? They say, well, my doctor told me and my mother has one and the neighbor told me she has one. The biochemical disorder is the only so-called disease I know of that's spread by word of mouth.
You know what? I was going to bring that up. That cracked me up when I read that in your book. And that's so true.
It's very true. It's just spread by word of mouth, because the underlying science is fraudulent.
Mm-hmm. But you've said that the private psychiatrists admit that it's only suggestive, not conclusive, that mental illnesses such as schizophrenia and bipolar have neurochemical and genetic causes, correct?
The honest ones do. And they even admit it in public. If you read their the so-called scientific psychiatric literature carefully, they always say suggests that, or maybe, or is possible that, needs more research. There was a recent journal that came out because of the commotion about the new forthcoming DSM, whether so-called...
Explain what the DSM is to people.
The so-called Diagnostic and Statistical Manual, which is a totally made-up, contrived document by psychiatrists who agree because they were trained the same way and they're conformists, who simply vote. There's no... It's not statistical, and it's diagnostic only in the sense that it pretends to diagnose medical or psychiatric diseases. Now, in a recent article I saw, they were questioning whether they should call these things diseases, disorders, or syndromes. And there is a dispute about it, but there is an increasing consensus that you can't call them diseases because there is no reliable scientific evidence that there is a bodily cause for any of these problems.
And it's my understanding that a lot of insurance companies are in cahoots with this, because people have to have a diagnosis in order to have insurance companies...
Totally in cahoots with it.
For them to pay.
They and the drug companies and the state, there's a conspiracy. And you know, the word conspiracy comes from the root S-P-I-R, which means both to breathe and spirit. Conspiracy means to breathe together. But it also means to think together. Now, the state, the drug companies, psychiatrists, and the insurance companies all think together, and the American public is the victim of this thinking.
Mm-hmm. And the fact that so many ads are peddled to people on TV during dinner hour especially is unbelievable to me. That seems to me it should be illegal.
Well, I think it should be.
Yeah. Can you as a psychiatrist do anything about that?
The only thing I can do as a person is speak. But unfortunately, I don't get the opportunity very often, so I'm very grateful to you for this.
Mm-hmm. So as a young psychiatrist just coming up, and when you just graduated and got your degree, did you start on this road of rejecting this medical model? How did that happen?
Well, I started as a naive trainee, but fortunately, my teacher was Tom Zoss at Syracuse, who wrote the classic Myth of Mental Illness, and who has been castigated and ostracized for his point of view. My colleague was Ernest Becker, who wrote The Denial of Death, won a Pulitzer Prize 2 months after he died. And so there was this culture of attempting to understand human suffering in non-medical terms, but also a critique of coercive psychiatry and the medical model. So I grew up with that. I grew up meaning that I got my psychiatric training in that way, and became a faculty member at the Upstate Medical Center after I finished my training, and wrote a book called In the Name of Mental Health, for which I was fired and blackballed from psychiatry.
That's unbelievable. Any kind of dissent?
Any kind of dissent in psychiatry is responded to, reacted to, with personal attacks, censorship, and state action. I've had state action taken against me for my publications.
In what way?
Well, they say that it's a medical misconduct.
Or malpractice, perhaps?
Well, I haven't been accused of malpractice, no. But just phony. The Department of Health doesn't know what it's doing. It hires medical psychiatric experts, and the psychiatric experts want to take away my license for saying what I say. So, you know, your audience should, and I'm sure they do, this is not a totally free country. Of course, we're the freest country in the world, and I must say that I'm proud to fly the American flag after the inauguration day. But in universities and in publications and in literature, thought is controlled. Especially in universities, thought is controlled. So if you're a dissenter or if you're out of bounds, you got to be very careful because the penalties are high.
So when you came out of school as a psychiatrist, was it your experience that led you to believe that the medical model was incorrect, or did you just trust the people who were saying that at the time.
It was the experience of seeing people involuntarily committed in mental hospitals and how they were treated there. I was a consultant in all of the upstate psychiatric hospitals, Marcy and Syracuse Psychiatric Hospital and many others. I went around as a consultant, and I could see how the patients were treated. These places are concentration camps, and for saying that, the state could come after me. So I hope your audience will be sympathetic when and if that happens. But the main objection was logic. I mean, it just doesn't make any sense to explain human behavior in terms of either neurotransmitters or, for that matter, the brain. We are being obstructed in our understanding of ourselves by this so-called decade of the brain in which more and more human behavior is being explained as brain activity. Mm-hmm. I think that's very destructive.
Yeah, I agree with you because I don't think the brain can be known.
Well, some things about the brain can be known when mm-hmm. it comes to things like strokes and tumors mm-hmm. and the kind of...
So the real disease.
The real diseases. Can happen. The real mm-hmm. diseases. Mm-hmm. But the relationship between mind and brain is a mystery. And for logical reasons, which I can't go into here, I don't think that logical gap can ever be bridged because you're basically changing languages. When you talk about the brain, you're talking about physical things and they can be measured physically. When you're talking about the mind, you're talking hermeneutically. You're talking in terms of understanding, interpretation, communication, values, purposes, all things
dreams.
Which can't be reduced to brain functions.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So tell us how you got involved in Buddhism.
Well, back in Syracuse, I was with a wonderful circle of people that included Tom Zoss, Ernie Becker, a man who I love, Rudy Lombard, who was vice president of CORE. I was active in the civil rights movement. A man like Stanley Diamond, an anthropologist who was a big influence on me, but the Buddhist influence was from a man named Agayananda Bharati, who was a professor of anthropology, but also a Hindu monk who taught me meditation in 1964. He was a personal friend, but that was all for the better because I got very good training from him, not only in understanding Asian philosophy, but also in techniques of meditation.
Mm-hmm.
And I studied with him for 16 years, at which point there were increasing number of Tibetan lamas coming over after the exodus from Tibet, after the Chinese invasion. And they had a lot to say about understanding the mind that I was interested in. So he advised me to get a Buddhist teacher. And so I went to Karma Trayana Dharma Chakra, which is a Tibetan Buddhist monastery in Woodstock, New York, and became a student of Kempo Karta Rinpoche, who is still, I consider, my main teacher and with whom I studied for many years. And then when Namgyal Monastery opened here in Ithaca, I became a full-time student, studied Tibetan language and logic and psychology. So I have long period of reflection and practice on a Buddhist point of view and approach to life.
Mm-hmm. And were you attracted to it initially as a kind of a healing for what you have been going through as a psychiatrist and being hassled and
ostracized? No, I was attracted
ostracized.
To it. I was attracted to it for its profound understanding of the human mind.
And you knew about that before you entered the educating yourself about
well,
it.
Well, thanks to Zoss and people like Becker, I took a degree in philosophy while I was a resident in psychiatry. So I've been very interested in ideas, Western ideas and, of course, Asian ideas. And it was the ideas that struck me.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
not just the ideas, but the way in which they resonated with my own personal experience and with my work as a therapist.
Mm-hmm. And do you think the philosophy that you've learned as a Buddhist has helped you as a psychiatrist and hence helped your clients greatly?
Yeah, very much, yeah.
Uh-huh. And a lot of people think of Buddhism as trendy, and in some circles they write it off. Did it take some time to talk some of your clients into believing that this was a real discipline that could help them?
Well, I don't talk
about
Buddhism.
Oh, you don't?
Unless they want to and they're interested. I mean, I have Buddhas in my office and my books on the table, and if people ask me about it, I'll talk about it, but I'm not a proselytizer.
Mm-hmm.
So I've translated what I've learned about Buddhism into Western language. So I approach it purely from a Western point of view. Having done that, then I went back and reread and researched Western intellectual thought and found that a lot of the themes in Buddhism have also been worked with and struggled with by Western thinkers. So it's very easy to present these things in Western terms that Westerners can understand without any reference to Buddhism or any other particular point of view.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Dr. Ron Lifer. He's the author of Vinegar into Honey, Seven Steps to Understanding and Transforming Anger, Aggression, and Violence. Let's talk about the book.
Sure.
It's a fascinating book. Tell us the initial philosophy around it.
Well, the initial philosophy, when I was studying with Kenpo Karta Rinpoche, they were teaching the Four Noble Truths. And these thoughts come from the first two noble truths. The first noble truth is that we all suffer. And we all suffer because we don't get what we want, we get what we don't want, and we grow old and we die and we get sick and life doesn't work the way we want. The second noble truth says that the causes of this suffering are what's called the three poisons.
Mm.
Now, the three poisons have been translated as passion, aggression, and ignorance, or lust, hatred, and illusion. But these words don't capture the meaning of it in a way that a Westerner can understand. But you take the first two, passion and aggression, I've translated them as desire and aversion. And mm-hmm. when you listen to the Lamas talk, that's what they talk about. I want it, I don't want it. Mm-hmm. Now, desire and aversion are two categories in Western thought. For example, in behavioral psychology, the basis of behavior is the search for pleasure and the avoidance of pain. And you can control people by controlling whether they respond to a stimulus with pleasure or with pain. We all go for the pleasure and we avoid the pain.
Mm.
So we're governed by desires and aversions. And when you practice meditation, this becomes immediately apparent to you, because when you look at the way your mind operates, there are three categories of what Buddhists call feelings, or tsorwa, which are I like it, I don't like it, neutral. And when you look in your own mind for any other category, you can't find it, because it covers everything. I want it, I don't want it, neutral.
Mm.
Now, the third one, ignorance, has to be understood in Western terms as having two meanings. One is that it's a denial of the realities of life. That's what ignorance is. Now, what are the realities of life from the Buddhist point of view? That we can't avoid suffering, it's a part of life. That everything changes. That's a Western idea, goes back to Heraclitus,
mm-hmm.
and that things have no inherent substance. And if you look at quantum mechanics, that's what the modern physicists say. Nothing is in and of itself separate and distinct from everything else, because if it was, nothing could interact. Everything would be floating around in its own little mm-hmm. solipsistic existence.
Uh-huh.
Now, we don't ordinarily accept these things because they're painful. We don't like to accept the fact that there is suffering in life, and we shrink from it. But we love its causes.
And people don't like change.
And people don't like change. That used to be a word in the 60s that was an explanation for why you were unhappy or suffering. Changes. And we all think we have a soul and we're distinct entities. And we have some solid internal substance which defines who we are. And if we look for it, we can't find it. And, you know, one of the Buddhist practices, particularly in Zen, is who is your original self? Look inside your mind and describe yourself to me. There is no self in the self. So mm-hmm. it's all pretend. The second meaning of ignorance is that we take ourselves as real, substantial, solid, serious, and the center of the world. So you put these things together and you get, as the cause of our suffering, I want it, I don't want it, and me.
I always think of the beginning of the self as this little spark.
Well, that's a good way to put it.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a little spark.
A
but, you know, spark is an energy.
Uh-huh.
Self is an energy. And, you know, we can talk about the energy in the world. Physicists talk about it.
Mm-hmm,
they talk
mm-hmm.
about heat energy and light energy and nuclear energy. Well, there's an energy of life
mm-hmm.
also.
Mm-hmm.
And it goes back, way back to the Big Bang. The energy of existence is differentiated and becomes more complex and becomes the energy of life.
Mm-hmm.
So I consider the basic problem of human existence is managing the energy of life.
Mm-hmm. And you talk in this book in terms that people can understand. You talk about how aggression and violence can often be triggered by people interfering with people's happiness projects.
Well,
talk to us about that.
Happiness project. You know, you take desire and aversion in that has two dimensions. One is the immediate sensuous dimension. I'm uncomfortable now and I want more heat or more chill it down a bit, or I'm hungry or that feels good. But for us humans, we learn during our socialization process to delay or defray our present desires and aversions for our future desires and aversions. Now, I call the future desires and aversions our happiness projects.
Mm-hmm.
We all have an idea of what will make us happy in the future, and we all have an idea of what we're afraid of or anxious about that would make us unhappy in our future. Those are our happiness projects. And, of course, we want to sustain ourselves even after death in whatever fictional sphere. So whatever we perceive in the present moment as possibly interfering with our future happiness or causing our future unhappiness or negating us will spark anger, aggression, and violence because our sense of ourself is a sublime version of the survival instinct. And anything that threatens survival at a physical level stimulates the fight-flight reaction, the fight part of which is aggression. Anything that threatens our happiness project or our sense of self stimulates the fight-flight reaction, the fight part of which is anger, mm-hmm. aggression, and violence. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So we can understand anger, aggression, and violence as being rooted in the perception that somebody is interfering with what we want, somebody is imposing on us what we don't want, and somebody is insulting or negating us.
And you talk about how people have to learn to let go of that.
Well, that's the paradoxical path to inner peace, is letting go of our tight grip on desires and our phobic aversion to suffering and to our taking ourselves too seriously. So it gets down, you know, to very practical terms of loosening up a bit, mm-hmm. and realizing we can't have everything we want. And that's becoming more apparent to the American people during this economic crisis. Mm-hmm. We can't avoid what we don't want, and the avoidance of suffering leads to more suffering. That is, whatever we fight becomes stronger. Mm-hmm. And attempting to assert ourselves and raise ourselves up above others just simply creates interpersonal and ethnic and national conflict. So we have to be willing to develop humility instead of this overweening pride and this fear of shame, which is what led us into the Iraq War, the fear of shame. Mm-hmm. Pride and shame mm-hmm. led us to the Iraq War. Mm-hmm. Now, hopefully, we can take a more, because of our national situation and our personal situations, we can take a more humble approach to life. But this is going to require an ideological shift in the nation, a mm-hmm. shift in the way we think about life.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You also talk in the book about, you have an example of a woman trying to help someone let go of anger, a woman who had been molested by her father and couldn't decide whether to confront him. Tell us a little bit about that story.
Well, this was a woman, like many others, who was sexually abused by her father. And of course, she was very angry about it. And the anger is understandable. But her father was still married. She had a family. And because of her anger, she had to withdraw from her family and reject them, from which she suffered. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So she wanted to reintegrate herself into her family. But in order to do that, she had to let go of her anger. Now, that didn't mean letting go of her condemnation of her father's actions. It meant letting go of the wish that it could have been different, because she can't change the past. And she had to make a decision about whether to go home and confront her father, or whether to go home and find a different way of relating to him, not excusing him for what he did, but enabling her to relate to the rest of her family in a loving way, the way she wanted to. And after some work and after realizing that her anger was... Anger is... A Buddha called anger is like holding a hot stone and expecting the other person to get burned. So she was angry at her father, but her father didn't know it. So she was suffering from her anger. Mm-hmm. Once she realized she was suffering from her anger, she could look at the situation in terms of basically a moral choice that she had to make of how she was going to deal with this situation. Now, there the therapist has to step back. It's up to the individual how they're going to choose it, what they're going to choose. I've had some people who have chosen to confront their parents. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That worked in some cases and didn't work in others. I've had some people, this woman particularly, who chose to see him in a different way, relate to him politely so she could relate to the rest of her family, but reintegrate herself into the family, which worked for her. Mm-hmm. Might not work for everybody.
So essentially, you're telling people that they have to take responsibility for their anger, for their own healing.
Buddha said nobody can wash the hands of another. See, this book is not really...
You're trying to help people to understand.
I say to people, look, I've been doing this for 45 mm-hmm, years. Mm-hmm. I've never changed anyone. Mm-hmm. People can change if they decide to, and maybe I can help them to change, but everybody has to work on themselves and change themselves. When it comes to working with our negative emotions, that doesn't apply to political problems. Mm-hmm. There we can all have some impact on society and politics, but in terms of working on our own emotions, only we can do it for ourselves.
Mm-hmm. But you give people tools.
Tools,
yes. Tools is what you're giving people. Yeah. Let's talk about the final step in your book, opening the heart. Tell us what that means. And
well, it's a phrase that's used in Buddhism, opening the heart, which really means softening in one's approach to life. And as I say in the last chapter, in order to understand what the open heart is, you have to understand what the closed heart is. And I think everyone can relate to what a closed heart is. A closed heart is somebody who stubbornly wants what they want, and they don't care about you or anyone else. They are stubbornly going to avoid anything they don't like. They've got a fixed, rigid approach to life, and they're narcissistic and selfish. So an open heart is a reversal of that process. It's an opening to that we may not get everything we want, and that's okay. There's always something to appreciate in life. It's also, very importantly, an opening to suffering. Opening the heart means opening to life. Opening to life means the whole caboodle.
And having compassion is a component.
For oneself, to start with, we all go through suffering, and there's an old story about the Tibetan Buddhist Milarepa, who was meditating in a cave for many years alone, and a dragon appeared, and he fought the dragon, and the harder he fought the dragon, the stronger the dragon became, until he realized, I can't do this, I can't win this, and he put his head in the mouth of the dragon, and the dragon disappeared. Now, that's a metaphor for the fact that if you fight your suffering, if you deny your suffering, if you deny your illness, your old age, or your death, or the prospect of death, or if you deny that you can't have everything you want and you can't avoid everything you don't want, those things will become your enemies. And if you open to them, you open to life that you, we can't have everything we want. And as we get older, that becomes more apparent.
It does.
And we can't avoid everything we don't want. And we have to be able to open to the pain of life, to our mistakes, to our debts, to the difficulties of relating to other people, to the fact that we don't live forever and there's no paradise on earth. And usually life is not going to turn out the way we expect. And we have to open to the fact that selfishness is not the path to happiness. The path to happiness really is helping other people. And everyone can experience this for themselves. When you help, ask yourself, are you happiest when you get what you want and you can lord it over other people who don't have what you've got? Or are you happiest when you're sharing and giving to other people and helping other people and you see their happiness? Everyone can experience this with their children, maybe with people they love. But this is a matter of this becoming a global ethic,
which is something we sorely need in this 21st century that has started out violent, just like the 20th was.
Right.
We only have a couple minutes left. Do you think your Buddhism has helped you stay in the realm of being a psychiatrist, since you're so opposed to so many of its tenets?
Well, people call me a psychiatrist. I don't think of myself that way. Of course,
really?
I have to act that way.
In
my public performances, especially with colleagues and with insurance companies. And people come to me identifying me as a psychiatrist with their ideas of what a psychiatrist are. And sometimes I can't work with that. I can't work with anybody who treats me like a psychiatrist. You know who I am? I'm Ron. What does that mean? I don't know. People come in and we try to just meet face to face, and to a certain extent I share my experiences with them to the extent that they may be helpful for them to know that I'm not perfect, I've made mistakes, I don't get everything I want, I suffer, that helps them relax and we can talk on an equal basis and then maybe I can help them. So yeah, my Buddhism, approach to Buddhism has helped me to help other people. Psychiatry's an obstacle.
Interesting point of view. Well, Ron Leifer, we have run out of time. Can you give some kind of contact information? Do you have a website?
I don't have a website, but my email is ronleifer@aol.com, and I'd be happy to correspond with anyone who's interested.
That's great. Well, thank you so much for joining us. And I do recommend his book. Pick it up. It's called Vinegar into Honey, 7 Steps to Understanding and Transforming Anger, Aggression, and Violence.
One more thing.
Sure.
I've just finished another book which expands on this one. It's on emotions, all the emotions, anger, depression, guilt, shame, pride, envy, jealousy, using the same basic paradigm, desire, aversion, and ego. And I just completed it, and I hope somebody be willing to publish it, and I hope it will be of benefit to people who read it.
Well, great. Well, thank you, Ron Leifer. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Tish.
Our audio producer is Nate Richardson at Rep Studio in Ithaca, New York. We are supported in part by the Arts of the Southern Finger Lakes in Corning, New York. Our theme music was composed by Diego Vega. And visit us online at outofboundsradioshow.com. We'll be back next week. I'm Tish Perlman.